Oh, good morning. Wow. You're here early. They said I would have a few more minutes to get things cleaned up before you got here. Well, I guess there's some of you up there, too. Wow. All right, now's as good a time as any, I guess. My name's Joseph. No, not that Joseph. Everybody knows him. I'm the one nobody remembers. Joseph the Levite, if you want to be technical. I guess around here it's easier just to say Joe. Joey, you like Joey? Okay. I guess this is Long Island. We can go with Joey the Levite if you want. Works for me. I can see you're getting ready to celebrate Christmas here. Guess that means you'll be opening some presents in the next few days, huh? Did you ever have that experience where you were opening a present that somebody got just for you? Maybe a family member that has interesting taste in gifts. You know, they wrapped it up all nice and pretty, put a big bow on it, put your name on the tag, and Christmas morning comes, and you're sitting there in the living room, and all the family's watching, including the one who gave the gift, and you feel a little bit of pressure because you know that they want you to really like their gift. And so you go to open it, you pull the paper off little by little, and finally you get to the inside, and your Aunt Betty has given you nail clippers. Or a necktie, or underwear, and the gift is something that you didn't really expect, or it's not exactly what you wanted, or even what you thought you needed. You've had that experience, right? But have you ever had one of those gifts that you didn't really care for at first, but it grew on you over time? You know, little by little, you started to find yourself liking it more and more, until eventually you got to the place that you couldn't bear to part with it. That's how it was for me with the gift that changed everything. Yeah, it was a day that started out pretty ordinary, just like every other day of my life, but it ended up being the biggest day of my life, that day that was going to change things far more than I could have imagined. See, as a Levite, I had a very special job. I got to work at the Jerusalem Temple. Well, I didn't always live in Jerusalem. No, I was born far away. But the temple for a Jewish boy in those days, it was the greatest place on earth. I mean, it was the place to be. It was full of the most amazing smells, like grilled meat and roasted grain, the wafting fragrance of incense. It was full of people coming in for the biggest experiences of their entire lives. You could feel the excitement. It was kind of what a Cooperstown might be for a baseball lover in your day, or maybe a Carnegie Hall for the aspiring musician, or a modern museum of art for an art lover, or maybe St. Patrick's Cathedral to an architect. You know, that kind of place. It was so exciting, only it was bigger even than that. Because you see, the temple was the place where God actually met with people. See, in our day, it was much different from what you're accustomed to. If you were going to experience God, you had to go to one certain place. That's the only place that God would ever reveal himself. And you had to go through all kinds of elaborate purification processes. And even then, even if you did all that, you were lucky if it happened in your lifetime. I mean, it was rare that we could actually remember people experiencing the presence of God. I mean, it happened sometimes, kind of like when Solomon first built the temple, if you remember that story, and the presence of God came in such a heavy way that everybody fell on their faces before him. Oh, it could happen, but it was rare. And when it did happen, it was completely life-altering. Yeah, the temple in Jerusalem, that was our pride and joy as a people in those days. It had been destroyed maybe 600 years before I was born. For a long time, our ancestors wondered if things could ever be the same again. But they had rebuilt it. And thanks to Herod the Great's renovations, it was the one good thing he did. It was magnificent by the time I came around. Yeah, see, I was born and raised in Cyprus, a little island off in the Mediterranean Sea. Maybe you heard of it sometime. But because I was born into a Jewish family with Levite heritage, it meant that when I was old enough to get a job, I got to move to Jerusalem and spend my days in the temple. All my boyhood friends were so jealous when they found out that was where I was going to get to work. Of course, every job has parts that you don't really like. You know, they get kind of tedious. You just tolerate them. That's how it was for me being one of the custodial Levites. See, my job was to clean up after all the sacrifices. It was a messy job, not for people with weak stomachs. I wish we had these things back then, and your washing machines would have made cleanup a lot easier. Let me just say, there was lots and lots of blood. Kind of got old sometimes, dealing with all the mess. Just like any other job, it could become a little bit mundane. But whenever that would happen, I would see somebody come in for the first time, and they had that look that said, "I can't believe I'm actually here. This is amazing." And it would remind me once again what a privilege it was to spend my days working in the temple. I was still in my early 20s on that morning that everything started to change. It started off really ordinary. There was a young couple that came in for their purification rites and consecration of the firstborn, you know. What's that? Oh, you're not familiar with that. Okay, well, let me see. Every time a Jewish woman had a baby in those days, there was this purification process that she had to go through. For about 6 weeks after the birth, she would stay home, pretty much isolated from everybody, cut off from the religious festivities of the community. She would be considered ritually unclean. I know it's hard for your modern ears to understand. It actually had benefits, believe it or not. But after that 6 weeks, she could rejoin the full life of the community if she went through a purification process. And what that meant was that she and her husband would travel to the temple in Jerusalem with the baby, and they would have to bring a sacrifice for her purification. Now, when Moses first spelled it out in the law, he said that ideally it would be a lamb. But listen, people, lamb's not cheap. Have you bought lamb lately? And so Moses made a little provision that if you couldn't afford a lamb, you could bring a couple of doves or some pigeons. Yeah, let me tell you, we didn't have the pigeon problems in our cities that you have today. So that was what every woman had to do for the purification after any baby was born. But if the baby was a firstborn son, there was another dimension to the process that had to happen. Remember the Passover? The very first Passover, when God intervened to rescue our people from slavery in Egypt. You remember how he did it? That magnificent show of power where he judged the Egyptians for their cruelty against our people, and the consequence was that their firstborn children died. It was a way of judging the injustice that they had brought about on our people. And that same night, God passed over our homes. He allowed our firstborn sons to live, not because we were sinless or perfect. No, of course not. We were probably in some ways just as guilty as they were, even though we didn't realize it at the time. But God made a way for us to go free so that we could go live in the promised land. And what he told us to do, you may remember, was to kill a lamb and put some of its blood on the doorpost so that the angel would pass over and our children got to live. Now, we had numerous ways of commemorating that through the years. One of them was celebrating Passover every year, of course. But there was another way that we remembered our freedom and the fact that it didn't come free. Maybe like you celebrate your 4th of July or your Memorial Day as a way of remembering that your freedom didn't come free, that it came with a great cost. Well, one of the ways that we remembered that was with the presentation of the firstborn son. You see, after God had rescued us from Egypt, he told us, again, through Moses, that because he let our firstborn sons live, that every firstborn son belonged to him. And what that meant is that whenever a firstborn son was born, you had to give him to God. Not as a literal sacrifice, of course. No, you would travel to the temple, just like for the regular purification, with the baby. And the mom and dad would come and they would present the baby to the priest, giving him over. The priest would say a few words. And then the parents would give a 5-shekel offering, a monetary gift, as a way of symbolically buying back the child. It was also a way of supporting the ongoing work of the temple. But it was a way of reminding us that our freedom came at a great cost. And then we would take our sons and go live our lives. And every time it would hit us for the rest of our lives that we actually got to have our sons with us and enjoy the benefits of their lives, it was a reminder of what God had done to set us free, to give us life as it was meant to be. Well, that's how it worked with the presentation of the firstborn and the purification rites. We would have couples coming in all the time for the normal baby purification, maybe 10 or 20 couples a day at peak time. And Sundays, we would have one or two couples bringing in a firstborn son, just to give you an idea of how that thing worked. And let me tell you, it made for lots of pigeon feathers to clean up, folks, okay? Well, that was a long history lesson. But on the day when everything started to change, it started out to be a pretty ordinary day. You know, the usual suspects were there at the temple, the priests, some of the widows who come for prayer, money changers, that sort of folks. And I was just going to my normal spot, getting ready next to the altar in case they'd needed me, when in walked this couple. And you could tell from the look on their faces, they were totally overwhelmed. I think at first they were just awestruck at the reality of being there in the temple. But you know, they also had that other look on their faces, the look of any parents with a six-week-old baby. I wish we had those things in our day. You have, what do you call them, selfies? Yeah? Boy, I would have loved to have one of those for every couple that came in with a six-week-old, because they have that look that says, I haven't slept more than 2 hours in a stretch for the last couple months of my life. I don't know if I'm ever gonna have a life again. You know that feeling? Well, that's how this couple looked that day. They were totally exhausted. You could tell they had traveled a long way. You could tell they were poor based on their clothing and the fact that they were carrying pigeons, not a lamb. Totally exhausted, totally overwhelmed, probably in need of reassurance, just like any couple at that stage, thinking, you know, they need some reassurance that they'll actually get through having that newborn experience. But knowing what I know now, I know that this couple needed some reassurance for another reason too. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah, it was a pretty ordinary morning. You know, an ordinary couple going about their ordinary acts of obedience to God. All of us temple workers going about our ordinary jobs. So ordinary it was that I almost missed the gift that would change everything. You see, little did I know that morning that God does extraordinary things in the midst of ordinary acts of obedience. They may seem normal to you, a job, a routine, ordinary. Meanwhile, God is moving things into place to do something so extraordinary that it could change your life forever. That's what he was doing that morning. We didn't know it, but he was moving things into place to do something greater than we had ever imagined. You may feel that way sometimes. Your normal life of bathing and feeding your own children, helping with homework, going through the same commute to the same old job day after day, helping an elderly neighbor with yard work. It's so boring. It's so mundane, you may think, that God can never do anything special in your life. God only does special things in the lives of people who go to exotic places for him, right? People who go live with the homeless, who move overseas to become missionaries, right? The Mother Teresa types. But you see, if that's what you think, you just might miss the fact that God often shows up in the most ordinary of people at the most unexpected times. He's called each one of us to do very ordinary things that honor him. And you might be surprised to find that God still does extraordinary things in the midst of ordinary obedience. But one of life's harsh realities is that the ordinary, for all of us, usually includes a great sense of longing. Some heartache, some hunger, some homesickness of the soul. I'm learning that we all have our pain. And it comes in different forms for all of us, but it's there. And eventually you realize that it's there, usually for much of your life. There's this longing that comes out of us. We cry to God with longing hearts, asking for him to intervene. And sometimes he answers, sometimes he does. Well, it seems like he doesn't. We're not aware of how he answers, or the answer is not what we expect, like the gift that we didn't want to get. That's how it was with two of the usual suspects who were at the temple that day, Simeon and Anna. They were people of great longing. We knew them. I mean, it was not any surprise that they would be around the temple that day. But what was a surprise was that they would both show up exactly when they did. That was the extraordinary part. I've known very few people in my life who are like Simeon. Maybe you've known someone like this. Someone who is so hungry for God, so desperate to hear God's voice that they will remove anything from their lives that might distract them from hearing from God. You ever know anybody like that? Well, Simeon was that way. He was unique, too, in that he actually heard from God. I mean, he didn't just talk to God. God talked back to him. And remember, this was a day before people could just go experience God's presence anywhere. I mean, this was pretty unique, right? At first, I thought he was just a weirdo. I mean, who goes around talking about how God spoke to them? Pretty unusual, if you ask me. Who gives up nice foods like steak and wine just so they can hear God a little bit better? Not me, but Simeon did. Yeah, even though he seemed pretty strange at first, he kind of grew on me. You know, eventually I came to admire his sincere desire for God. It was very authentic, the way he yearned for God. Nobody really knows how old Simeon was. We had our guesses, but the truth is he predated any of us who worked at the temple. Nobody was there when he first started there. He was getting up there. And yet it was almost like he never aged. He had like some invisible source of life and vitality that kept him fresh and green. That was pretty strange. And you know his favorite thing to talk about? His favorite thing to talk about was the consolation of Israel. He was always waiting for the consolation of Israel. We were all waiting for the consolation of Israel, of course, but in the way that you might wait for the Jets to win a Super Bowl or the Mets to win a World Series, can it happen? Sure. In our lifetimes, not a chance, right? That's how it was, you know? We were waiting for the consolation of Israel like it could maybe happen someday. He was waiting on the edge of his seat as if it could happen at any moment. What's that you say? Consolation. You don't know that either? Okay, when my people talked about consolation, we were thinking of the ultimate relief, encouragement when you couldn't go on. Even that doesn't quite do it. Maybe you could think of it this way. In your day, if you can imagine nighttime when there's a terrible storm going on and you're home alone and the power goes out and the house is dark and the wind is howling and you feel afraid. You're afraid of maybe that a tree will fall on your house in the night, or maybe that something will come and get you in the darkness. So afraid you're trembling. But the next thing you know, you open your eyes, and the sun is shining bright in a blue sky, and there's a pleasant breeze coming in the window. The sun has risen on a whole new day full of possibilities, and the dark night is over. That feeling you get, it's consolation. And we were waiting for that as a people. We called it the consolation of Israel. And for us, it wasn't just kind of a vague notion. It was very specific. You see, the consolation was going to be a person. We called him Messiah sometimes. The Greeks called him Christ. A person who would come and who would put our oppressors in their place, who would turn off injustice, just like shutting off a valve, who would enable us to live life the way that God intended it without the possibility of ever messing things up again. That's what the consolation of Israel was going to come and do. Now, Simeon, he understood why we needed it so bad. See, it wasn't just because of all those bad people out there doing bad things. No, it was more because of the problem in here, in our hearts. The reality that we were all wandering away from God. That we had continued to find cheap imitations for what only God can give. And value those more than we valued Him. That's why we needed somebody like the Messiah, the consolation of Israel, to come and rescue us. Well, like I said, Simeon was unusual in some respects. Not long after I moved to the temple, he told me that God had spoken to him. And at first I was like, okay, here we go. And he leaned in as if he didn't want anybody else to know this. But he said that God had told him that he was actually going to live to see the consolation of Israel with his own eyes. In his day, it was going to happen. Maybe that's why he never aged. Maybe God was keeping him alive or something. For me, I just thought it was kind of something to joke about, and so I'd give him a hard time whenever he came in. Hey, Simeon, did he come yet? Could have gotten in real trouble for that kind of thing. But listen, we thought it wasn't going to happen in our lifetimes, and if it did, it would at least happen with a bang, you know, a warrior on a white horse, that kind of thing. It wasn't just going to be God speaking quietly to some old man and then just slipping in subtly. It was going to happen in a way that you couldn't miss it. Well, Simeon, he would come into the temple usually once a week, maybe twice on an unusual week. And he had just been in the day before, which is why I was so surprised to see him on this particular morning when things started to change. That couple, the poor couple, had come in, and they were kind of waiting right over here with their pigeons to come and make their sacrifice. They were in the line of people. And I could see Simeon come in the back door. He was running faster than I had ever seen him. I mean, listen, for somebody that age to run, that was unusual in itself. But he came up to me just as fast as his old legs would take him, and I could tell on his face that he had been up all night. He was anxious, as if something big was about to happen, and he didn't want to miss it. And when he came up to me, he said, Joey, did any young couples come in to present a firstborn son today? And I pointed at the couple right over there. I said, just them, Simeon, just the poor ones with the pigeons. That's all. They haven't even gotten up here yet. And when he looked at him, I could see that look of anxiety just kind of go away. It was replaced by relief, consolation. And I actually saw his eyes start to fill up with tears. Simeon walked over to where the couple was standing. He was going slower now. He would look up at the dad and then at the mom and then down at the baby. And when he got over to him, he put his hand on their shoulders, one hand on the dad and one hand on the young mom. And he looked down at the baby and he said, he's so beautiful. Can I hold him? That was an awkward moment. You know that moment when a stranger comes up to a new mom with a baby and says, can I hold your baby? That was what was happening here. She was looking and I could tell in her eyes, she's not so sure. Who is this old guy? Is he some creep? Is he going to harm my baby? And eventually her wheels are turning. She gets to the place that she says, he's just a harmless old man. And she hands the baby over, but a little bit reluctantly, but keeps a hand firmly on the baby until he's nestled securely into Simeon's chest. And then when Simeon was finally holding the baby, he stopped trying to hold back the tears. It was like the floodgates opened. All those tears of longing that had been stored up in that heart for decades came flowing. Tears of joy, as if God had just delivered on a promise that seemed impossible, as if the thing he had been waiting for all of his life had just finally come to pass, as if the dark night was over and the sun had risen on a whole new day. Well, when Simeon finally gathered himself, he held the baby up high like this. I could see the mom was a little nervous, but she was close by. He lifted the baby up and he looked up towards heaven. And he prayed. And he said, Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now, dismiss your servant in peace. For my eyes have seen your salvation. I played those words over and over in my mind through the years. First, I didn't realize what he was saying, but it eventually hit me that Simeon was saying that this ordinary baby boy from a poor, exhausted couple, that this was the one we had waited for. The consolation of Israel, the one who would answer the cry of every longing heart, that this was him. Well, just when I thought Simeon had lost it, he continued his prayer. He said, for my eyes have seen your salvation, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel. Let me tell you, I almost dropped my mop right then and there. I mean, for Simeon to say that this baby, okay, if he's the Messiah, if I give you that, that he came not just for us, but for the Gentiles, for people of every race and every nationality, get out of town. I mean, that was blasphemy. For him to say that there in that temple, the Gentiles, okay, I realize most of you are Gentiles. No hard feelings, okay? But for him to say that God sent the deliverer for people of every race and every background, not just us, that was just something we couldn't comprehend. All right? Because the Gentiles were the people who were ruining our lives. They were the ones who were oppressing us. They were the unclean ones. They were the source of all of our troubles. But you see, Simeon understood something that it was going to take me years to understand. That because the problem was not just out there with those people, but in here in our hearts, the solution had to be something that could cure the problem of the heart for anybody of any race or nationality or background. You see, there is no such thing as a deserving person or an undeserving person. We've all wandered away from God. We all need the solution that he gives to the problem of our hearts. You see, we all were desperately waiting, even though we didn't realize it, for this baby who would come and rescue us most of all from ourselves. In our day, it was the Jew-Gentile divide that we prided ourselves on, but in your day, it may be something else that you use to create a sense of insider and outsider. But listen, the truth is that in this baby boy, Jesus, God came to rescue all of us. He is the answer to the cry of your longing heart, regardless of your height or weight or your skin color or your gender or your nationality or whether you finished your college degree or how much money you have or who you are attracted to, regardless of any of that, Jesus came for you. He is the answer to the cry of your longing heart. It would take me years to get that into my thick head. Much like the other thing that Simeon said at the end of his prayer, where he called that baby the glory of your people Israel. I mean, it's a wonder the walls of the temple didn't fall down, because we were standing in the glory of Israel. That temple was our glory. That was where God would reveal himself to people. That was where we met God, not in a poor, ordinary baby boy. But once again, Simeon was understanding something that it was going to take so long for me to get. That it wasn't actually in a building that God revealed himself, that the temple had always been pointing forward to this baby. That in him, we would meet with God. It was as if God was saying in that first Christmas, here I am to you. I'm giving myself to you. I'm the answer to the cries of your heart. And I'm going to rescue you, not in a special building, not through a set of religious observances, but in a person who doesn't look the way you expected he would look and who's going to redeem you in a way you can never have imagined. Well, Simeon handed the baby back to his mom, and you could see the parents were totally overwhelmed. I mean, now it wasn't just being in the temple. It wasn't just the newborn thing, but it was as if God had spoken to them. It was as if Simeon's words up until this point had been a total reassurance. And then before he turned to leave, he tried to whisper something to him. But you know how it is when a person that age tries to whisper in public. We all heard what he said. He leaned in really close, and he said something about how that baby was going to encounter opposition all throughout his life and suffer, and how one day a sword was going to pierce that mother's soul. What a terrible way to interrupt a happy moment, right? I mean, up until that point, it had been total reassurance. Not only did the couple need reassurance that they could get through those newborn months, but listen, it had been at least 6, 8 weeks, maybe more, since they had seen an angel. It had been a long time since the shepherds had come, called by the angels. I mean, even if they had heard from God himself, 6 weeks of a newborn can make you forget lots of things. And they needed reassurance that this actually was the Son of God, that God was doing something special in this boy. And what Simeon had said up until that point was exactly what they needed. How could he go say something terrible about suffering and opposition and a sword? But now, looking back over the years, I can see that even those words were the reassurance that they needed. Because you see, many years later, that mom was going to watch her son be killed under the curse of God. And she was going to wonder, how could he be the Son of God if this is happening? And Simeon spoke those words from God as reassurance for many years later so that she would know when that happened that this is not a detour from God's plan, that this is not a surprise. No, this was the way it was supposed to be heading all along. Because only in that boy offering up his life could we be set free. Could our hearts be cured? And you see, for that firstborn son to be literally sacrificed meant that never again would any firstborn sons have to be offered up and then bought back. After then, no more lambs, no more pigeons would ever have to die. No more people would ever have to wonder if they have done enough for God to forgive them. Because it was this firstborn son who was going to purchase every human life, who is going to pay the necessary price for our freedom so that we can know the life that God intended us to live. Well, the couple walked away and they realized after all this, gosh, we haven't made our sacrifice yet. And so they had to get right back in the line. And just then, I couldn't believe what happened. Another one of the usual suspects walked in. This one was Anna, the old widow. We all knew Anna around the temple. She had been there a long time. She was even older than Simeon, if you can believe that. Some people thought she was 84. Some thought she was 104. We weren't really sure. But it wasn't unusual for her to be in the temple. What was unusual was when she got to the temple. We appreciated Anna for the fact that she had turned her longing into something hopeful. She had turned her desperation into a way to benefit other people. You see, when Anna was still a young wife, her husband died. And she would cry out to God desperately for many years to give her a husband, somebody who would satisfy her need for companionship, somebody who would provide for her material needs. Because in those days, people didn't have life insurance and widows didn't have other fallbacks. I mean, they were on hard times. And so she cried out to God. Sometimes she would even give up food for days at a time as a way of reminding herself that her longing for companionship was ultimately a hunger for God, something that only He could fill. And He never answered her prayers, at least not the way that she was hoping He would. So she spent her days in the temple, helping out. She would show up in the morning, ask if we needed anything to be done, pitch in. She would pray for whoever came along, talk with whoever was there that needed encouragement. We liked having her around. She liked being there. Well, Anna came in this morning, right when Simeon finished talking to that couple and they got back into the line. And this was a morning that was becoming more extraordinary by the moment. Even though it had started out so ordinary. Talk about uncanny timing. I mean, Herod's temple was a massive structure. For Anna to show up at that spot at just that moment, nearly impossible, unless God was orchestrating something extraordinary. Because He wanted her to know, and Simeon to know, and us to know, and you to know, that Simeon's words were not just a fluke, that they were spot on. Well, Anna came in. She saw the baby right over here, kind of in the same place where he was before. She ran up to Mary. She asked to hold the baby. Mary didn't think twice this time. She figured, well, it happened once. Might as well do it again. Passed the baby over. And just like on cue, Anna started crying tears of happy joy, just like Simeon had. She burst out in words of praise to God, almost the exact same as what he had said, telling us that this baby was the consolation of Israel, that he was the one we were waiting for, that his coming is the answer to the cry of every longing heart. You might not have realized it yet, the way that Anna did, the way that Simeon did, the way that I eventually did, although it took way too long, that everything that you long for is ultimately a longing for Him, Jesus. That everything the world offers you in beautifully packaged gifts really is just an imitation of what He alone can give. He may still seem to you like that gift you weren't expecting or you didn't want or don't need. But let me just give you a little invitation. Over these next few days of celebration, and then as you re-enter your ordinary days, would you consider the way that I eventually considered? That Christmas, this baby's birth, is God saying to you, here I am. That this boy, Jesus, would you consider that He might be the answer to every cry of your longing heart? I've got lots of cleaning to do. It's been good to be with you. See you next time.